What do you say to a young progressive or an Arab American who says to you, I just can't vote for Biden again, after what he's enabled in Gaza? What do you say to them?
Excellent question, Mehdi Hasan. Let's see if we can try to answer it today, shall we?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and other affiliates, both terrestrial and streaming, not to mention most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. All right, before we get to our main coverage, just a quick note that primary elections are coming up on Tuesday, May 7 in the great state of Indiana. And then the following Tuesday, May 14 in Nebraska, Maryland, and West Virginia, with each state having much more on the ballot than simply the presidential primaries, which are already, by and large, settled in advance of each party's nominating conventions over the summer. So, for example, next week in Indiana's open primaries, which means you can choose which one you wish to vote in, Republican or Democratic. In addition to the presidential contest, there are important primary races for the U.S. Senate on the Democratic side, for governor on the Republican side, as well as for a number of U.S. House races, state Senate races, several school district referendums to raise revenue for academic initiatives and school programming and increases in teacher pay. So remember, please, it is not only the presidency that is up for grabs this year, but both the House and U.S. Senate, among other things.
Yeah, and be sure to make sure that if you know anybody in those states, especially young people, help them understand the importance of going ahead and voting in the primaries, especially to make sure that they're actually registered and have what they need.
Harangue them? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Find the young people and harangue them? All right.
Yes, and help them understand what they need to do. It's kind of a complex situation.
Yes. Nonetheless, keep in mind also, whatever happens in the presidential race is going to be tremendously affected by which party ends up controlling one or both chambers of Congress. So let's keep that in mind. Des, you've got a report coming up, hopefully later today, on just a few of the things that are happening in Congress.
Yes, indeed, because Democrats have control of the Senate for now.
And, of course, as you have heard me mention a few times on this program, these primaries are also a very good chance to make sure that you are registered to vote as you think you are registered to vote since the last time that you voted. The last thing you want is any surprises this November during the general election, at least on that score. So primaries this year are a good chance to at least help avoid any such surprises during the critical November general elections. Okay, let's see here. Police moved into the pro-Palestinian encampment out here at UCLA on Thursday morning dismantling many of the tents, pushing out most of the protesters, and arresting more than 200 people. The operation caps 2 days of upheaval that began when UCLA declared the camp, quote, unlawful, and continued when a mob of pro-Israel counter-protesters attacked student journalists and the pro-Palestinian camp on Tuesday night, with police taking hours to stop that violence. On Thursday morning, officers wearing body armor, helmets, and face shields methodically pulled apart the barricade as protesters tried to hold together the assemblage of plywood and metal facing. Police launched flares that arced over the encampment, according to the LA Times, igniting with piercing blasts as smoke filled the air from fire extinguishers that demonstrators sprayed at the police. At least one officer is seen on video shooting rubber bullets into the otherwise peaceful crowd of protesters. Officers were able to move protesters out of Royce Hall. That's one of the main campus buildings out here at UCLA. After a series of tense scuffles, some protesters appeared to leave the scene on their own. Many were arrested, however. LAPD officials said 209 people were taken into custody. Many were booked on suspicion of failing to disperse. That would be a misdemeanor, according to the to an LAPD source to the Times. It's not clear how many of those arrested are actually UCLA students. There were several fronts of the overnight operation, they report, with police using flashbang-type devices that echoed across campus. The confrontations with protesters by police were, of course, mirrored elsewhere around the nation over the past 24 hours. At Dartmouth, for example, 90 protesters were arrested. 4 were arrested at pro-Palestinian protests at Yale. 34 were arrested at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when police dismantled a pro-Palestinian encampment. 15 at Fordham University in New York City. 29 people arrested early this morning after a pro-Palestinian protest at Stony Brook on Long Island. At the University of Texas in Dallas, 21 people were arrested after police broke up the pro-Palestinian encampment there. That's just a sample of the dozens and dozens of schools where mostly peaceful protests by those outraged at Israel's assault on Gaza, where tens of thousands of mostly women and children have been killed over the past 6 months in Israel's response to the Hamas attack in Israel that killed more than 1,000 last October, where all of that continues. President Biden spoke about the campus unrest during remarks on Thursday morning at the White House.
Before I head to North Carolina, I wanted to speak a few moments about what's going on our college campuses here. We've all seen images, and they put to the test two fundamental American principles. Excuse me. The first is the right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld. We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent. The American people are heard. In fact, peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail. Throughout our history, we've often faced moments like this because we are a big, diverse, free-thinking, and freedom-loving nation. In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points. But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy. But dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked. But let's be clear about this as well. There should be no place on any campus, no place in America, for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. It's simply wrong. There's no place for racism in America. It's all wrong. It's un-American. I understand people have strong feelings and deep convictions. In America, we respect the right and protect the right for them to express that. But it doesn't mean anything goes. It needs to be done without violence, without destruction, without hate, and within the law. You know, make no mistake, as president, I will always defend free speech, and I will always be just as strong in standing up for the rule of law. That's my responsibility to you, the American people, and my obligation to the Constitution. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, have the protests forced you to reconsider any of the policies with regard to the region?
No. Thank you.
Mr. President, do you think the National Guard should intervene?
No.
That was Joe Biden, President Biden, at the White House on Thursday morning. Now, we have been able to spend a lot of time on these still expanding protests with everything else that's been going on at the same time. And given the speed, frankly, at which the story has been changing in recent days, by the time we report on anything specific, the story seems to have changed by the time many hear this program, whether it's via podcast or in some cases via our air affiliates who may run the show on the following morning. In short, I support peaceful protest, whether it's in favor of ending the war in Gaza, in support of a Palestinian state, and by the way, in support of an Israeli state. I do not support Israel's far-right, corrupt Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the atrocities that he is ordering, and he needs this, frankly, this war to continue forever, else he will be ousted, tried on a number of felonies, and now most likely on war crimes. But beyond my general support for peaceful protest, and yes, sometimes dissent does lead to chaos, Mr. President, despite that, and my support on all sides, as protesters see fit, I've also been concerned with the violence by which many of these large peaceful protests have been met by armed and armored riot police in recent days. In New York City, at the Columbia University campus, which kicked off this national wave, police reportedly said that protesters were all peaceful when they were first called in by university officials to clear out the original encampment. At more and more universities, professors and other administrators are now joining the student protesters, and the number of protesters in these crowds who are not students at all, well, that remains unknown. But there are a number of other aspects to these protests that I'd like to touch on a little bit today, as they're not receiving the attention that they deserve amid the "if it bleeds, it leads" news coverage of some of the confrontations largely touched off by riot police in recent days. As Thomas Zimmer writes for his Democracy Americana newsletter this week, across the country, authorities, sometimes university leadership, sometimes elected officials, have decided that the right answer to peaceful student protests and encampments on college campuses is to mobilize the coercive powers of the state and escalate the situation with brute force and violence. Mass arrests, police in riot gear beating unarmed students and faculty, heavily armed state troopers marching on the campus, turning the scene into the type of carnage that bloodhounds on the right eagerly use as justification for demanding the National Guard be deployed, which you heard Joe Biden reject in his remarks to reporters on Thursday just now. But as far-right Republican Senator Tom Cotton and Speaker of the House Mike Johnson have done, men who are just generally excited to use whatever level of violence is deemed necessary to force anyone who is coded as, quote, left wing into submission. Why the National Guard needs to be called out. Zimmer writes, you don't have to like the pro-Palestinian protests or even agree one bit with the substance of what these young people are criticizing and demanding, or with the way that they are doing it, to see how this is a wildly disproportionate response, an outrageous suppression of speech because the powers that be reject the content of what is being said and consider those who are speaking to be dangerous or subversive or unworthy. Large swaths of Americans' mainstream elite and polite society want to pretend that this is all a necessary answer to rabid anti-Semitism and escalating hatred of Jewish people and life amongst indoctrinated radicals. We're supposed to believe that what was happening at Columbia before the mass arrests was something like the left-wing extremist equivalent of the Unite the Right Nazi rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Yes, Donald Trump even compared it to that, said, compared to what's going on right now, that Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville was a peanut, he said. In Charlottesville, as you will recall, neo-Nazis marched with torches, heavily armed right-wing militants descended upon the city, counter-protesters were assaulted, one person was killed. Ask yourself, writes Zimmer, have you seen anything like that? Armed vigilantes, violent clashes. In some corners of the left, conversely, there is a reflexive impulse to deny that anything anti-Semitic is ever said or done at these pro-Palestinian protests. This type of denial is not only morally disingenuous, it's also politically disastrous. The left, and anyone who cares about the plight of the people in Gaza, should come down hard on those who see these protests as an opportunity to display their vile hatred. The fact is that, yes, sometimes criticism of the Israeli government at these protests crosses the line into anti-Semitism, and there can be no justification for blocking Jewish students from entering or leaving university grounds, or for assaulting them, or for berating them. Zimmer says, I don't think it's asking too much of the left in America and around the West to always be aware of the fact that anti-Semitism is a massive problem in all of our societies. You are not helping your, we are not helping our cause by pretending otherwise, says Zimmer. But he writes, let's also insist on acknowledging that the biggest threat to Jewish people is not coming from college students. America has experienced a drastic increase in political violence and hate crimes in recent years, almost all of it perpetuated by right-wingers. One of the two major parties is united behind Donald Trump, who subscribes to all the usual anti-Semitic stereotypes and has long been pushing anti-Semitic tropes about Jews only liking money, only being loyal to Israel. By the way, many of the pro-Palestinian protesters on college campuses right now happen to be Jewish. Trump, meanwhile, has no discernible conception of American Jews as Americans, only as them rather than us. That's also, Zimmer notes, the party of QAnon and the great replacement of white Christian ethno-religious nationalism. If you are rightly worried about anti-Semitism, but you find yourself in alliance with that party, find yourself calling for a crackdown on the same groups that these people want to go after? People exploiting fears of anti-Semitism in order to advance their reactionary crusade? Well, it is really time to take a deep breath and reconsider. Again, Zimmer continues, Jewish Americans have a right to demand that the so-called left and everyone at these pro-Palestinian protests be vigilant and hold the line against anti-Semitism. But unless we characterize every form of criticism of the Israeli government and any expression of solidarity with the Palestinian people as inherently anti-Semitic, the idea that all of these protests are just manifestations of vile anti-Semitism is rather bizarre. And he's right. A lot of people want us to ignore that there are many Jewish students among the protesters, or want us to see people with no connection to the university, anti-Semites from off campus, inevitably attracted to these events like moths to the flame because they see it as a chance to stir up trouble. They want us to see that as somehow representative of the students. Well, we must not fall for it, argues Zimmer. And yet, in the face of such outrageous suppression of protests through state agents, the powerful phalanx of elite opinionists, largely on the right, who have told us for about a decade now that the, quote, free speech crisis on college campuses is a clear and present danger to freedom and democracy. Those voices have had nary a critical word to offer about this crackdown against peaceful protesters on these same college campuses. On the contrary, the crackdown at Columbia specifically has garnered an enthusiastic response from such prominent members of the free speech crisis industrial complex who have sided unequivocally with the authorities in these cases. The same circles who have been presenting themselves as uncompromising fighters for free speech, imploring us to understand that speech must not be curtailed on college campuses just because you people on the left may disagree with it, well, they are all now fully on board with speech that they do not like being suppressed by the state. Weird, huh? Writes Zimmer. Yeah, weird. Weird. But of course, in no way surprising at all. Those claiming that free speech is being all but shut down on our college campuses by our elite universities, those very same people are now calling for those elite universities to call in the riot police, call in the National Guard to do what? To shut down free speech. Go figure. And yes, we have a long tradition in this country of protest, and specifically protests on college campuses, whether they are protests over the Vietnam War in the 60s or the Iraq War in the 2000s, with authoritarian figures often calling for them to be violently shut down. That, even though, by the way, as most of the country eventually comes to agree years later, the protesters were right. So all of this continues to unfold, of course, as we go to air today. But it seems to me that some perspective, at least some historic perspective, is in order as at least a bit of a counter to the disproportionately violent scenes of confrontations with protesters by cops in riot gear that are being shown all over the news, all over the cable news, the national news, the local newscasts, etc. On MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes on Wednesday night, Hayes offered some very welcome and, yes, much needed perspective.
In the spring of 1969, a group of students at Morehouse College, historically black college in Atlanta, were frustrated by what they said was the school's slow progress on civil rights. And they'd protested, they'd been rebuffed. So they locked the college trustees in their office for 2 days and essentially held them hostage. Now, one of the trustees was Martin Luther King Sr., father of the recently slain civil rights leader. He began having chest pains, and one of the students later said, "We let him out of there so he wouldn't be accused of murder." That student and his classmates eventually gave up under a promise of amnesty from the college. The college reneged, and he was expelled. It would be years before he was rehabilitated, decades before he became known the world over as actor Samuel L. Jackson. Now, I tell this story for two reasons. One, to remind us that college activism has long been a part of college education. The other reason, though, is to get a sense of proportion, which seems lacking today. As we watch the disturbing imagery emerge from campuses at Columbia, UCLA, University of Texas, University of South Florida, so many others, where cops, or in some cases mobs, took down pro-Palestinian student encampments and protests, as well as professors and journalists and just random bystanders. The cumulative effect of all this coverage, along with some unverified assertions from police and politicians, has been to drive home the idea that student protests are basically a terrorist-level threat, that they have to be neutralized by battalions of cops armed like soldiers with MRAPs and sonic cannons. The reason this seems to me a reaction that's out of proportion to the protests themselves. It seems especially true when you look at some other campuses like Brown University, where administrators negotiated with student protesters who took down their encampment, and Wesleyan University, whose president said the protesting there was nonviolent and non-disruptive, adding, as long as it continues in this way, the university will not attempt to clear the encampment. Now, these universities, crucially, have reiterated their important existing rules against anti-Semitic invective and harassment, certainly, while also protecting assembly, which seems sensible, also out of step with what you're seeing elsewhere. Because ever since October 7th, when Hamas committed its atrocities in Israel, there has been this obsessive media focus on college campuses. And that's true partly because there are genuine issues worth debating, including the degree to which universities are creating spaces that are hostile to pro-Israel Jewish students where they feel under threat, or universities, the degree to which they're suppressing pro-Palestinian speech. And those issues really do matter. But the way that so many prominent voices have focused so exclusively on colleges feels honestly a bit decadent to me. Like we're doing a paper doll version of the conflict because the actual reality of what's happening in Gaza is so horrific, unceasing, and high stakes. It's more enjoyable to argue about what college kids are doing than to confront the human misery and destruction that's happening in the actual conflict. That is, of course, the source of these protests. What seems most worth debating isn't campus speech, but whether the U.S. government should continue to fund and support an Israeli war in Gaza that has pushed more than 1 million people to the brink of famine, a war that has damaged half of the buildings in Gaza, a war that has failed to bring home most of the hostages held by Hamas, that has, in fact, led to the death of some of those hostages, as well as the deaths of an estimated 34,000 Palestinians, including roughly 10,000 women and 13,000 children. Is that ongoing effort morally defensible? Is it strategically wise? Are we as a nation doing the right or wrong thing in continuing to support it? Now, whenever that becomes a question, it almost becomes reflexive to challenge the questioner. And I can't help but think of the protests that marked the lead up to the Iraq War, which were both widely attended and widely attacked. And many, many prominent war supporters, including one-time student protester Christopher Hitchens, blasted those demonstrations. And he pointed to the fact that some of the people organizing the protests held genuinely odious and fringe views. For instance, the view that North Korea is a workers' paradise and a great place. That's a horrible view. There were protest organizers with bad views, lots of them. There were people at the protests with terrible views. There were people who thought 9/11 was an inside job. I would argue with them myself at protests. Did that have anything to do at all with whether the war in Iraq was moral and prudent? No. The war in Iraq demonstrably was neither. On that, the protesters were right. Which brings us back to Columbia University, where 56 years ago, almost to the day, student protesters took over the same building, Hamilton Hall, that was occupied earlier this week. They, too, were forcibly removed and arrested. Many were bloodied and beaten for protesting, among other things, the university's involvement in the Vietnam War. They believed the war was a moral catastrophe and the U.S. should stop waging it. They were right. And the fact that there were absolutely genuine extremists among those protesters in 68, again, had no bearing on whether they were right or not about that. What I find particularly maddening about our focus on the protesters of the conflict is that it's an evasion. It avoids the difficult task of being universally empathetic to our fellow human beings and truly reckoning with the scale of devastation that is wrought by our country in our names with our support. In the aftermath of 9/11, we waged a global war on terror for 2 decades that killed an estimated 430,000 people, many of them children, women, elderly, innocents. In Vietnam, we are estimated to have killed more than 1 million people, huge swaths of them, civilians, women, children, male non-combatants, old people, and the like. Can you even make sense of those numbers? I can't. No one can. It's hard to think of them, to contend with them as actual real human beings who lived lives before you took them, who are people like you or I, who were loved by the people in their lives. It is much easier to get angry at the spoiled brats on college campuses. Why are they being so disruptive? What are they so upset about? If you feel that way, which I can understand, honestly, I felt irritation and anger at protesters many times in my life, even ones I was ostensibly on the same side as, broadly speaking. If you feel that way, just try recasting the question. Why are all these people so upset that we're helping a government wage a brutal war that's killed 13,000 children? The question kind of answers itself. To take seriously the scale of human suffering that's happening in Gaza doesn't mean you must come down the side of the protesters, certainly. There are many people who think the war is a brutal but necessary campaign for Israel's defense. What it does necessitate is that you weigh all the human suffering against the actual end game of the conflict that is currently being waged and is unarticulated as of now. A conflict the U.S. continues to support. Our humanity demands we focus on those questions first and last.
Chris Hayes on MSNBC on Wednesday night. I will only add that it is no mistake that many, yes, on the right, are exploiting these rather ordinary by American standards incidents on campuses around the country in a presidential election year. Of course, Democrats didn't have to tempt fate by holding their national convention in Chicago this year, given what happened in 1968, but this is where we are, and perspective and proportion is needed. Not just perspective on how these campus protests are playing out, as tens of thousands are being killed overseas by a U.S. ally who we continue to support, even as the Biden administration tries to cool things down in any way that they can, at least in any way other than a full stop of military support or condemnation at the U.N. Security Council. But political perspective in a presidential election year where there are a whole lot of people, in fact, a whole lot of anti-Semites, from the top of the Republican Party on down, who are suddenly concerned about anti-Semitism, if apparently no longer about free speech on campus. Perspective. And in this case, political perspective. Journalist Mehdi Hassan, during an interview with progressive New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about 2 weeks ago, asked her what she says to young progressives or Arab Americans who are struggling this year with a vote for Joe Biden, thanks to the administration's support, often reluctant support, but support nonetheless, for Israel and its far-right leader Benjamin Netanyahu's atrocities carried out against the people of Gaza. AOC here makes a number of what I believe are some very important points that I truly hope my listeners will pay close attention to today as she offers the political perspective that I think is often missing from our media coverage of all of this in recent weeks and months.
What do you say to a young progressive or an Arab American who says to you, I just can't vote for Biden again? Mm-hmm. After what he's enabled in Gaza, what do you say to them?
I mean, I think everyone comes to this prospect and this conversation with a different history, different background, what they bring. You know, for an individual Palestinian American that has had their family killed, there is nothing. I mean, I am not here to lecture anyone. I also think that this election is more, in my personal view, I believe this election is about more than the president. And also, it's not just one election that's happening. We're having hundreds of elections.
Yes.
The balance of Congress, the balance of the House, the balance of the Senate, and the presidency. And I have a vested interest in protecting democracy, not just here domestically, but globally. And it isn't, I truly do not believe this as a lesser of two evils type of situation. I think about what conditions do I want to be organizing under in the next 4 years.
Yeah.
We can look at both of these individuals oppositionally as well, depending on what issue you have. But I would rather, even in places of stark disagreement, I would rather be organizing under the conditions of Biden as an opponent on an issue than Trump, who is not, he seeks to dismantle American democracy. And I am taking that personally very seriously.
Yes.
Because we will not be able to organize for any movement towards anything if we are facing the jailing of dissidents. I mean, this is the kind of authoritarianism that he threatens.
Fascism.
And we have to take it seriously.
Yes. We have to take it seriously. Would you rather organize against Joe Biden or against Donald Trump, who, according to his own defense secretary, wanted to shoot protesters in the street during the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests? We have, as bradblog.com legal analyst Ernie Canning wrote at the blog on Wednesday, a binary choice right now between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. One has to go back some 56 years to find an election where a third-party candidate has received even one electoral vote of the 270 that are needed to win the White House. Ernie argues that a vote for one of the third-party candidates right now, Jill Stein of the Green Party, Cornel West of the People's Party, independent candidate Bobby Kennedy Jr., is a vote for Donald Trump. He argues that for progressives and those on the left who care about democracy and, yes, about the issues that are bringing out student protesters at college campuses, that for those people, staying at home, he argues, is a vote also for Donald Trump and for his fascist, autocratic undemocracy, where peaceful protesters will not just be arrested, but potentially killed if Donald Trump this time has his way. There is a lot on the line this year, to say the least, from Gaza to Ukraine to right here at home. And I will hope that the media will keep all of it in perspective. And I hope our listeners will as well. Quick break, and we are back with, some stuff going on in the U.S. Senate that you probably have not heard about. But you should. Desi Doyen is here with that and her latest Green News report, all ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. No, I know that music usually means we're going straight into the Green News Report.
Yes, it usually does.
We're not doing that per se. Well, maybe, sort of, kind of, in a little way. Between the Trump trials and the campus protests and the wars in Ukraine and Israel and the dysfunction and the Republican House and, oh yeah, the presidential election and the need to defeat encroaching fascism, you know, stuff like that, it may be hard to notice that there are actually other things going on.
What?
Yeah, I know. including, believe it or not, in Congress, including a report following a major investigation by House and Senate Democrats released just this week, I believe, into the ongoing decades-long campaign of deception and delay waged by big oil to block climate action. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about this in your Green News report coming up momentarily, but it seemed to me that this story could use some more focus, could use some more light here. And so, you know, given how little coverage, frankly, it is receiving elsewhere, it seems to me we could just afford to spend a few more minutes on it today before the GNR.
Yes, I agree.
Desi?
So this, again, as you say, is a joint report from House Democrats and Senate Democrats that reveals how big oil executives are still deceiving the public about the impacts of burning fossil fuels and how they are destabilizing the climate.
You mean Republicans were not involved for some reason in this
Republicans were not involved in the investigation or the report, but they were there at the hearing, and of course they were throwing out pot shots, as they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, the 90s called, they want their talking points back. So, you know, okay. Enough of that.
Right.
We do link, by the way, to the full hearing and key video excerpts in today's Green News Report post at bradblog.com, greennews.bradblog.com, if you want to go directly there. So back in 2019, when Democrats regained control of the U.S. House after the 2018 midterms, they launched an investigation into the oil industry and its decades of deceiving the public about climate science in order to preserve its business model and its profits. So the Congressional Democrats' investigation builds on previous blockbuster investigative reports from outlets like nonprofit Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times that exposed internal oil industry documents from decades past and scientific reports and other documents that definitively confirm that the oil companies knew back in 1959 that the use of fossil fuels would destabilize the climate.
In 1959.
Yes.
The oil companies knew that what we are facing now with a destabilized climate, they knew that was coming decades ago.
Yes, they did. But instead of sounding the alarm, those investigations revealed how over the last 60, 65 years, big oil executives instead chose deception. They literally used Big Tobacco's playbook to spread disinformation about the harms of burning their product.
You guys did a great job with lying to the public, the American, the world about cigarettes.
Let's do that.
Let's hire those people. And now we'll lie about oil.
Right. So Big Oil spent hundreds of millions of dollars, potentially even $1 billion by now, to fund a covert network of lobbying groups, dark money groups, think tanks, and right-wing media outlets that were there to help them deceive the public by spreading disinformation, fear, uncertainty, and doubt about climate scientists, about climate science and scientists and solutions like renewable energy, calling those things unworkable and unaffordable. Which we now know, of course, is absolutely untrue.
And they've done a hell of a job at it.
Yeah.
They're really good at lying about these things.
The report also shows how Big Oil used their political influence to buy elections and use their lobbying power to halt remedies and solutions, especially after the right-wing Supreme Court overturned campaign finance laws in their Citizens United ruling. So they did all of this while pulling in upwards of $6 billion a year in permanent taxpayer subsidies. You are literally paying Big Oil three times over, first in taxpayer subsidies, then again in paying for retail energy costs, and then again by allowing Big Oil and the fossil fuel industry to pollute for free and destabilize the climate while you get to pay for the damages.
Pretty nice work if you can get it, huh?
The new report by the Democrats builds on all of that. So they get to use congressional subpoena power. So they obtained internal documents. And
that, by the way, is because they have the control of the Senate.
Right.
They don't have that subpoena power over in the House necessarily.
Not anymore. Right. That's the reason why we get to hear about this report, because the Democrats still control the Senate for now.
Right.
So they got all these internal documents from Big Oil like Exxon and Chevron and from the American Petroleum Institute and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that show and confirm that Big Oil executives did know for decades that they're destabilizing the climate and that they're still doing it. They're still working to delay the transition. They're still greenwashing their image now while fighting climate policy behind the scenes. So Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Senate Budget Committee Chairman Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island laid out the key findings in a hearing on Wednesday. Whitehouse explained how the oil industry's strategy has shifted, like Exxon using a greenwashing campaign, pretending that they're going to invest in algae as an alternative biofuel.
Yesterday, Ranking Member Raskin made public approximately 4,500 new documents of interest from this latest review, exposing new details about the fossil fuel industry's decades-long campaign of denial and deception. The collective record shows the fossil fuel industry going through four phases. Phase one was its own scientists' warning very clearly and accurately about the climate dangers from unchecked fossil fuel emissions. Fossil fuel industry scientists began ringing climate alarm bells nearly 65 years ago. Phase two was the industry looking at what those warnings meant for profits and setting up an elaborate, covert operation to undermine the very science its own scientists had revealed, and to bring industry influence to bear in politics to prevent any remedies. Phase three was the hoax phase, using that elaborate, covert operation to spread lies that climate change was a hoax, that the science wasn't settled, and that remedies would do more harm than good. But climate change would not become a non-issue. It began to wreak visible havoc around the world. The hoax strategy collapsed, and big oil had to evolve from denial to duplicity.
And this is where the report really picks up. It shows how big oil executives are still conspiring to undermine climate solutions since the signing of the UN Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. Quote, big oil continues to conceal the facts about their business model and obscure the actual dangers of fossil fuel. Serious deception around natural gas now that is at the heart of big oil's current efforts to prolong the energy transition. So studies now show that natural gas can be as big an emitter as coal because of the oil industry's failure to plug leaks and stop the flaring of climate warming methane. So the hearing also included witnesses like Sharon Eubanks, who was a lead attorney in the blockbuster Big Tobacco lawsuits back in 1998.
We had her on the show, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yep. And that forced Big Tobacco to pay $206 billion for their similar criminal deception of the deadliness of the addictive tobacco products. In her testimony, Eubanks referenced the Global Climate Science Communications Action Plan from 1998 from the American Petroleum Institute.
Because that sounds like it's a good thing, a global action plan.
Yeah, it ain't. It was spelled out, Big Oil's plan, yep, to undermine climate science and how they were exactly going to promote doubt and denial. Now, Eubanks called for U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland to investigate the oil industry for racketeering.
Yes.
And several senators also said that the industry should have to pay damages for fueling the crisis.
Yes.
Bernie Sanders, in an exchange with University of Miami professor Jeffrey Supran, who studies the fossil fuel industry and its messaging and its use of the Big Tobacco denial playbook, covered that.
We have the receipts. We have overwhelming evidence that this industry has known since twice my lifetime about the dangers of their products, and they knowingly and deliberately created a multi-decade, multi-billion dollar campaign to confuse.
And the result of that is that countries all over the world were very slow moving in attempting to deal with climate change. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's enshrined in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's most recent assessment that this history of disinformation and lobbying has delayed action on climate change worldwide.
Do you have any understanding of how many hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars in damage will take place as a result of that misleading campaign?
It's hard to ascribe specific dollar values to specific actions because obviously we live in a complex, multi-connected society. But at the same time, And also, I'm not an economist, but economists have studied this, estimate that by around 2030, the consequences of global warming could include a $240 billion COVID-like economic shock every 5 years. So
every
this is very
five
much,
years. Yeah. Well, in my view, it should not be state government or the federal government having to pick up the bill. I think it's time to ask the people who caused that problem, who lied about that situation, to pick up the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So it is truly mind-blowing to me to consider how much further along we might be today had Big Oil not lied back in 1959. But this is where we are. So
this is where we are, costing us trillions in dollars, costing us thousands, if not millions, in lives.
Yes, and much more to come.
And the good fight continues. Thank you very much. And that's another reminder why it's important to vote this year. Because, again, the balance of the who controls the House, who controls the Senate, is also on the ballot this year, along with everything else. All right. More on that and a whole bunch of other things. Let's get to it on our latest Green News Report.
Bangladesh is experiencing the longest duration of unprecedented hot weather in its recorded history.
Extreme heat and storms grip Asia. New study finds just 56 major brands are responsible for half of global plastic pollution. Plus,
this history of disinformation and lobbying has delayed action on climate change worldwide.
Congressional probe finds Big Oil still trying to deceive the public.
All of those deceptions and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
As you can see, there's some very bad weather heading in, and so they've asked us to ask people to leave the site and seek shelter. I'm devastated that this could happen. So if you don't mind, I think we're going to have to just do a rain check.
Mind? I'm delighted. I'm starting to love this climate change thing. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, so sad. On the one day that Donald Trump is not in a criminal trial, his rally gets canceled due to inclement weather.
Sad.
I know. What else you got for us today?
Well, an enormous swath of Asia, about 2 billion people, have been suffering for weeks in a record-shattering heat wave, with some areas topping 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. And it's not even summer yet. The intense heat has forced schools to close in Bangladesh, the Philippines, and India as temperatures climb to dangerous levels. Other areas have been hit with severe storms and hurricane-force winds. In Guangdong, China, widespread flash flooding has collapsed highways and bridges, killing dozens. Mm. Studies show that human-caused climate change, driven by the burning of fossil fuels, is increasing the intensity and frequency of extreme weather events like heat waves and severe storms. In other news, negotiators made modest progress this week on efforts to fast-track the first legally binding international treaty to end plastic pollution that is contaminating land, water, and air, and people around the world. The talks, held in Canada, succeeded in voting in language calling for limiting the manufacture of plastics, but not specific production cuts, after intense lobbying by plastic and chemical companies and major oil and gas exporters, including the United States. Plastic is currently made from fossil fuels and chemicals, and the plastic manufacturing process itself is a significant contributor to man-made climate change. Without limits, plastic production is on track to triple by 2050.
Oh, man.
A study released at the start of the plastic treaty negotiations has revealed the world's biggest known plastic polluters, the major brands responsible for most plastic pollution. A painstaking global tally across six continents found just 56 companies are responsible for more than half of all branded plastic pollution. Beverage companies like Pepsi and Nestle topped the list, but number one was Coca-Cola, accounting for 11% of all global branded plastic pollution.
So Coke is it.
The researchers confirmed that recycling is insufficient and that production caps are critical to reduce plastic pollution. In politics, congressional Democrats this week released a new report revealing how the oil industry has conspired since the 2015 signing of the Paris Climate Agreement to mislead the public and, quote, conceal the facts about their business model and obscure the actual dangers of fossil fuels.
You don't say.
The report builds on previous investigations that exposed how the oil company's own scientists in the 1960s accurately predicted the climate impacts of fossil fuels that we are now seeing today. And then the fossil fuel industry spent millions over decades to undermine their scientists' conclusions, deceive the public, and use its political power to block solutions.
That sounds like my oil companies.
Publicly, the industry denied those investigations, but the report shows that privately, oil executives confirmed their validity and adopted a strategy of, quote, deception, disinformation, and doublespeak to delay the transition away from fossil fuels.
Sounds like a business plan.
The report also details how companies are now lobbying to lock in natural gas infrastructure to preserve their profits, while internally acknowledging that natural gas is not compatible with climate goals. Here's Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland.
Internal BP documents show that ensuring a future for natural gas was their goal. They wanted to, quote, advance and protect the role of gas and BP in the future of the energy conversation.
That's right, an endless bridge to the land of the carbon kings, where America stays dependent on their polluting products for eternity or until the final climate disaster.
An endless bridge to the land of the carbon kings.
Mm-hmm.
For much more on all of these reports and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Lots of troubled waters today.
Indeed. Have we mentioned lately how important it is to vote?
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or you want to go back, listen to it again, or share it with friends, family, or people you hate, you can do that anytime for free at bradblog.com. There is no paywall because we are 100% supported by listeners like you who hit one of those donate buttons or who go to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Thank you in advance. You can drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebook's mastodons and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog, and you will find her at Green News Report.
Yes, please come by and say hi.
We will see you there at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
I'll be there to lay me down.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.